Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The recent death of Kevin Ward Jr. at Canandaigua Motorsport Park provoked questions about confrontations between drivers throughout the history of professional racing. Ward was killed when he left the relative safety of his car and was struck by three-time NASCAR champ Tony Stewart's car. Wrecks happen all the time in professional motor racing. Drivers overwhelmingly survive these accidents, but they don't all walk away unscathed. Viv Bernstein is a freelance journalist who highlights the challenges that face NASCAR drivers after the smoke clears. We found her article, Crashing Without a Cushion, NASCAR Drivers Have Little Help with Concussions, in the New York Times. And Viv, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for inviting me.
The legacy of concussions and head injuries has become a huge challenge and story in football and boxing and other professional sports. Do we have any idea of how many drivers are affected in racing?
That's a very difficult question to answer because there is no union. There is nobody tracking these older drivers. Nobody really knows some of the symptoms that they're dealing with 20, 30, 40 years after they raced. Back in the day, before there were soft walls, before there were other safety measures, these guys took crazy, crazy hits to their heads and continued racing, and they thought nothing of it at the time. Mm. They didn't realize how dangerous it could be. So, yeah, there could be dozens, there could be hundreds, who knows, of drivers who have experienced head injuries and are feeling those symptoms even today.
And you speak with a number of drivers, some who were recently hurt, some, as you mentioned, you know, were hurt dozens of years ago. The crashes are not always catastrophic. I mean, sometimes drivers just keep on driving. How common is that for racers?
Again, it's very hard to answer because it's really up to the racers to say, hey, I am hurt. I should not be on the racetrack. Drivers typically don't do that. And athletes are trained, mentally trained, to push forward through injury. That's something you see in every sport. Not surprising to see that in racing as well. What Dale Earnhardt Jr. did 2 years ago when he stepped out of the car and said, hey, I have a problem, I've had some concussions, that was almost unprecedented in NASCAR. Sent a huge message to others in the racing community. However, I still think today, there are drivers who take hits to the head and keep racing.
Well, Dale Earnhardt Sr. died in the 2001 Daytona 500, and since then, new safety regulations have been put in place. So is NASCAR responsible for helping in driver recovery or expenses in case of injuries?
Well, NASCAR has insulated itself from responsibility. In the way the organization is structured, these drivers are independent contractors. There is no union. There is nobody looking out for them except for them. You're not going to see the lawsuits that you've seen in the NHL, that you've seen in the NFL. However, these drivers helped build that sport. They helped build that sport into a machine that can generate an $8.2 billion television contract. These drivers who helped build the sport, perhaps NASCAR can help them, given that they're generating these kinds of dollars.
Well, NASCAR drivers operate on many different levels. Some are paid, like professional sports stars. Some have big sponsorships. Others are just kind of making a living race by race. Do they all have the same kind of risks in the end?
Absolutely. Now, NASCAR is just like other sports. There are major leagues, there are minor leagues, there are stars, and there are other guys who are there who are not stars, who just race every week and live off the money they make every week. And yeah, it's a burden to have to be able to support themselves if they have these major catastrophic injuries.
Yeah, no safety net. Well, you spent a lot of time with one such driver, Eric McClure, not a particularly winning driver, but he did crash at Talladega, Alabama in 2012. He was kind of a second-tier driver living race to race, and he felt he had no choice but to continue racing despite his injuries. First, what were his injuries?
Well, he had a horrific crash at Talladega. Talladega is a racetrack known for its crashes, these multi-car, 12-car, 15-car pileups. The way racing is designed at those tracks, it creates those wrecks. In McClure's case, he had lost his brakes. So when he crashed and went streaming towards the inside wall, he couldn't slow himself down. He hit the wall at 185 miles an hour. Now, understand, he had a much more catastrophic crash than the one that killed Dale Earnhardt. However, NASCAR has so many ways to improve, has improved racing safety dramatically since that crash, and that's why McCoor survived. However, he was knocked unconscious. He had a severe concussion. He had internal injuries that have caused issues for years since then. He has now memory issues. He has now mood issues. These are all signs of some significant brain damage. And yet he has to continue racing, even though he is now at risk, if he gets another concussion, for some very serious issues much further down the line.
NASCAR, you tell us, has initiated concussion tests at the beginning and end of each season. Eric, however, is still racing. Is there an incentive for him to lie about concussions or to continue racing even if injured?
Well, first of all, I don't know that Eric McCoor has or would lie about injuries. However, there's a tremendous incentive to keep racing, even though he risks further damage given the number of concussions he's had. He's already had three significant concussions in his career. The more concussions he has, the greater risk he has down the line. But there's a tremendous incentive to just keep racing. Now, I'm not saying that he has lied about anything, but there is an incentive to keep for drivers in general to not reveal their concussions and to continue racing. Jeff Gordon, a four-time champion, was asked about that after Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s injury, asked if he would withhold information if he had a concussion, if it meant it would cost him a championship. And he said, yes, he would. Jeff is one of the most respected drivers in NASCAR, and for him to say that sends a message to drivers all the way down to Eric McCoor as well.
And you spent time with a number of former racers who, I guess, this kind of crashing and just driving on behavior had been sort of normalized. Now some of them struggling with long-term effects of hits to the head. And you spoke to, you know, doctors at Boston University about these brain injuries, some of which can only be diagnosed after in a post-mortem. How did they talk to you about living with injuries that were incurred many years ago?
Unfortunately, I was not able to interview Fred Lorenzen, the driver who was voted into the Hall of Fame in May. He has been diagnosed with dementia. He lives in a nursing home in Chicago. His daughter believes that he has a disease that we've seen in football players and in hockey players. That disease can only be, it's called CTE. And his daughter believes that Fred Lorenzen has that condition. Can't be diagnosed as long as he's alive. I don't know how to put this, but at some point it's possible that Fred Lorenzen could wind up being the first driver to ever be diagnosed with this condition. Mm.
What are some of the long-term effects of head injuries that could come from these kind of high-impact car wrecks?
Well, what we're seeing and what I discovered in talking with a number of drivers is a lot of drivers have memory loss. I had a long discussion with Bobby Allison and his wife about the issues that he's facing. And his wife told me 30 minutes after I leave, he will not remember the conversation that we were currently having. It's sort of devastating to hear drivers as beloved as him struggling in that way. There are a number of other issues. What we've seen is mood swings in drivers who have had numerous concussions. We have not seen, as far as I can tell, the suicides in other sports NASCAR has not experienced that. But really some very devastating issues. One driver talked about depression, that he had been on 15 different medications to deal with depression that could be very well directly associated with his traumatic brain injury and his wreck.
Well, Viv, thank you so much for your time, especially at a busy time for you.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Viv Bernstein, a North Carolina-based journalist who's covered NASCAR for the New York Times for 12 years. You'll find a link to read her article, Crashing Without a Cushion, NASCAR Drivers Have Little Help with Concussions. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, we're going to remain in the brain for an historical look at somnambulism and the story of a 19th century sleepwalker whose case inspired early psychiatrists to search for a cure. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. According to the National Sleep Foundation, up to 15% of Americans experience sleepwalking. While certain therapies, such as hypnosis and antidepressants, have been shown to reduce incidence of sleepwalking, there is no specific treatment for the condition. Even back in the 19th century, there were efforts to cure it. This piece comes from Backstory with the American History Guys and producer Eric Mennel.
On the night of June 24th, 1833, Dr. Lemuel Belden received a message. There were concerns about the behavior of a young girl in Springfield, Massachusetts.
I was called under the impression that she was deranged, and such at first was my own belief. She was struggling to get out of bed, complaining very much at the same time of pain in the left side of her head. Her face was flushed, the head hot, eyes closed, and her pulse much excited.
Jane C. Ryder was a servant for a wealthy family, and she had had a fairly long history of sleep disturbances that went back into her childhood.
This is Benjamin Reese. He teaches at Emory University, and he stumbled onto Jane Ryder's story a few years back.
It was reported that she often slept too long, and that as a child she had a number of episodes of sleepwalking. And those started to get more intense as she came to work for this family.
At first, the paroxysms...
A paroxysm is a fit or an attack.
...occurred only in the night, and generally soon after she went to bed. As the disease advanced, they commenced earlier. She then fell asleep in the evening, sitting in her chair, or rather, passed into the state of somnambulism. For her sleep, under those circumstances, was never natural.
So some of the things that she would do in the middle of the night would be setting the table perfectly for breakfast.
Having dressed herself, she went downstairs and skimmed the milk, poured the cream into one cup and the milk into another, all without spilling a drop. She then cut the bread, placed it regularly on the plate, and divided the slices in the middle. And this, with her eyes closed, she finally returned voluntarily to bed.
And when she'd wake up in the morning, she'd wonder,
why had somebody else done my job for me while I was sleeping?
Eventually, word of Jane's behavior got around. Her sleep-induced chores were written up in the local newspaper, and people wanted to see for themselves.
People would show up to watch the spectacle of her strange nighttime activities. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear exactly how people knew when to show up, but there don't seem to be any reports of people turning away dissatisfied. She was something of a medical curiosity.
It got to the point where Jane was not only doing work in her sleep, she was undoing work. Work she was paid to do. Things like pulling clothes from her dresser and hiding them in places she couldn't find when she woke.
And apparently after a while, this became bothersome to the family that was employing her. They decided, and apparently Jane herself agreed.
Arrangements were made for Jane's removal to the hospital in Worcester.
The state lunatic asylum, which had only opened the year before.
Where she could enjoy that seclusion which seemed essential for her cure.
What's important to note here is that just a few years prior, Jane wouldn't have been considered insane. In the 18th century, insanity was an entire way of being.
A complete delusional set of beliefs or a kind of reversion to an almost animalistic state of behavior.
But by the time Jane Ryder was making breakfast in bed,
the concept of partial insanity took hold, and that is that you could be completely sane in most aspects of your life. Mm-hmm. But there would be one set of behaviors that could set you off, either religious delusion or some kind of fixation or troublesome behaviors in your sleep. So insanity started to become fractionalized in a way.
A lot of this was caught up in ideas similar to phrenology, that different areas of your skull revealed different personality traits. The skull, the brain, and madness were all being broken down into their component parts in the 19th century. And with medical advances, scientists thought that if you could locate madness, you could cure it. Essentially, everything must be curable. Which is exactly how Jane C. Ryder, a young female servant who sleepwalked, was placed in the asylum system, a system mostly populated by the criminally insane.
December 15th. Paroxysm rather singular. She is full of melancholy like a roguish child. December 19th. She was more disposed to melancholy. She once said her head ached and felt strangely. She appeared very much like a person insane. December 21st, very well and wakeful all day, but in the evening had a paroxysm of complete insanity. Talked, ran about the house, and refused to take her medicine. When forced to take it, she shed tears and fell into a sort of hysterical sobbing, which lasted some minutes.
Belden thought the problems were food-related. Specifically, he blamed her restlessness on eating too much dried fruit. But even controlling Jane's diet didn't fix the problem. So doctors were forced to try more drastic cures.
To warm the feet, which were always cold, the nitromuriatic acid bath was prescribed.
She was given everything from opium to ether to medications that would make her vomit.
Her head was also shaved.
Leeches were applied. She was bled profusely. She had
leeches? Her
leeches, yeah. She was blistered also. Pus would ooze out. There was some thought that it would draw out whatever fluids were not harmonized within her body causing her to behave in this way. So she went through this very painful and difficult set of treatments and experiments. And after a while, it was clear she wanted to get out of there.
Kind friend, as it was your wish that I should write to you respecting my health, I have a good opportunity now.
This is from a letter Ryder wrote to Belden just before being dismissed from the asylum. And reading the letter, the words don't seem like those of a woman who's effectively been a lab rat for the past few months. They seem more like a woman who wants to leave and will say whatever she needs to make that happen.
I am very happy to say I'm much better now and think that being a little more unwell than usual has had a very good effect. The time has passed very quickly.
Do the doctors in the end feel like they've cured her?
In the final write-up of the case, they said that her symptoms had become much more manageable, which was, in a way, an admission that they couldn't completely cure the problem. Hmm. Now, asylum superintendents at that time, they always had an out because they claimed that mental illness was universally curable if it was caught early in its development. Hmm. And so they often took pains when they couldn't cure somebody to show that this was a disease that had been growing for years and years before that it was ever brought to their attention. And the fact that Jane Ryder had been experiencing bouts of sleepwalking since she was a young girl mm-hmm. helped give them cover.
One thing that was interesting about this story is, like, where I can't tell if by putting her in an asylum, it's a humanitarian effort that they want to treat her. That seems like that's what Belden, the doctor, it seems like that's his motivation. But simultaneously, it seems like the family, her employers, are trying to just kind of get her out of their hair. I mean, do you get a sense that both those things are working in confluence with each other, or one is more powerful than the other?
I think both are working together, and they're often indistinguishable from each other. The reigning idea behind the asylum movement was that all people had access to mental health and to productive lives, and that when medical conditions prevented them from fulfilling their potential, that society had an obligation to restore them to full capacity. That was the PR, and often the reality was quite different when mm-hmm. people who were simply inconvenient to others, as Jane Ryder seemed to become to her employers, found themselves incarcerated either through coercion or through outright involuntary confinement. That tension between the humanitarian mission and the control of unruly individuals was always present through the history of the asylum.
And we don't know what happened to her after she left the asylum?
Well, we know she went back to working as a servant. Mm-hmm. And periodically, newspaper and magazine reporters would inquire into the case and give brief accounts of how she was doing. But she slips back into the obscurity of the world of 19th century serving women.
It's strange to think that mental illness might have been a way out of that obscurity, even if temporarily. and it's difficult to know what Ryder was actually thinking. After all, she wrote these letters knowing full well they would be read by the doctors treating her. Whatever the case, it was these letters, and others like them, that helped give authority to the asylum movement, that helped launch a century and a half of institutionalization.
I feel as if I never could repay my friends for all they have done for me. Indeed, I know I never can. All I can do is thank them and deny myself everything that would be injurious to my health. I have nothing more present to write. Your most obedient friend, Jane C. Ryder.
And that story brought to us by Backstory with the American History Guys and producer Eric Mennel. Up next, we're going to head to the frontiers of modern-day medicine, the science and ethics of artificial wombs. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. People wanting to have children have many more options than they used to. Still, adoption, surrogacy, in vitro fertilization, and all the other methods depend on reproductive biology. In other words, someone has to carry and eventually give birth to each human baby. But what if there were another way? From Aldous Huxley's Brave New World to the Matrix trilogy, science fiction has long imagined babies gestating from conception to delivery in a lab. Artificial wombs may soon be a reality. Zoltan István is a futurist and a philosopher and journalist and author. He wrote about the science and ethics of artificial wombs, or ectogenesis, as the technology is formerly called, for Motherboard. Zoltan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, so first of all, what does this term ectogenesis actually mean?
Well, in theory, it really just means having a living organism in an artificial womb or outside of the human body. That's the technical term. But what it's really kind of come to mean is more the matrix feeling of, you know, growing a human body outside of the mother. And, you know, just gives us a lot of sci-fi kind of feelings to mm-hmm. it.
And that image, you know, you mentioned the matrix. I think of that scene with all of those sort of pods where humans are growing. What would the technology for ectogenesis look like in real life?
You know, in real life, it's going to be a lot more, I would say, human friendly. I almost imagine it as giant aquariums filled with amniotic fluid, very easily to be visible, lots of cameras and a number of wires kind of going into a growing fetus. And you'd be able to monitor it and perhaps even stimulate it. There might be things that you could do to create a kind of feeling of love or something being applied to it, even though it is, you know, separate in this type of container.
Why would a parent, especially a mother, opt for external gestation in an artificial womb?
Well, you know, so this is the number one question. I'm going to give you my emotional point of view because it's something I was not didn't do in the article, but I recently had my second daughter, and my wife had to go through a C-section, and I can tell you, as a husband watching one's, you know, the most important person in your life be cut open, organs are spilling out. It's very shocking to see that something like that happen. And yes, our procedure went safe, but it's not a safe surgery. It's a major surgery. And so from just going through this incredible, dangerous ordeal is my reason that I would want ectogenesis. So I don't have to actually worry about my wife dying on the operating table. Or also it's quite crude actually to pull a child from that environment and hope it starts breathing and then put it and clean it all up. And that first the child can't breathe because there's a lot of mucus and blood and stuff all over. The environment of doing, you know, an artificial womb would be far safer, far cleaner, far more managed. And you could there'd be a lot of different type of technologies that would just literally eliminate, you know, you're talking like 95% of the risks of childbirth. And don't forget that 800 women a day die, according to the World Health Organization, die a day from childbirth. It's mm-hmm. it's a very serious thing.
Well, how close are we to making this technology a reality now?
Well, so we have most of the technology available to start experimenting with this, with human fetuses and such. We really do. The problem is that there are rules, there is legislation, there's bureaucracy, and there's just public opinion to worry about. They've already grown a goat fetus who, you know, full term, it's not that big of a step to do that with a human being. It would probably take 2 to 3 years of developing the technology. But what really is getting in the way and what could be 10, 20, and 30 years out is whether governments are going to allow this, because who's going to experiment on a child and have it go wrong? That's those kind of trials would be almost unimaginable in our society that, you know, doesn't like to do those kind of things. So the technology is basically here. The possibility of doing it is quite far out.
We're speaking about ectogenesis, or in layman's terms, the artificial womb, with Zoltán István. He's a futurist, philosopher, and author. Well, Zoltán, let's say that artificial wombs do become a safe and viable option for hopeful parents someday. There is the argument that this takes the burden off of women to carry and give birth to a child. I'd love to hear more. Can you illuminate some of the ethical arguments for and against ectogenesis?
Well, sure. I think, you know, primarily the most important argument in favor of ectogenesis is the fact that you're going to be able to monitor your child from basically being a zygote all the way to a delivery date. And I'm not sure if that delivery date's going to be 9 months anymore. Might be out further, might be 18 months. Whatever is best for the development of the human brain. And you know what's great is you're going to be able to monitor every heartbeat. You're going to be able to, you know, monitor the movements. You're going to be able to feed it the very best nutrients it gets. The mom no longer gets sick and has the flu. Now, also, you know, from a woman's working point of view, a professional point of view, it's also going to be favorable if they don't want to take time off or have maternity leave. A lot of people have suggested that the discrepancy between women's wages and men's wages for the same job has a lot to do with maternity leave. So I think women might be able to use it who want to have children, but who also don't want to give up their careers.
But this also brings up questions about ethical dilemmas surrounding issues like designer babies, for example, or genetic pretesting, you know, that you can create a baby with a higher IQ, but then what if its IQ doesn't quite measure up? Then is the fetus just expendable? You know, this sort of things. Are these questions being thrashed out anywhere?
So you're getting into kind of the frontiers of these questions, which are so fascinating to me as a, you know, as a futurist. You know, this is, again, why this subject is such a political minefield, is the idea of designer babies. Yes, it's exactly what would happen is people would then, and we're already, you know, at the level of trying to start doing designer babies. You will probably see that happening in the next 2 or 3 years as people start choosing sexes, as people start, you know, trying to eliminate bad genes and stuff like that. And of course, in ectogenesis, in the artificial womb, people would be doing that exact same thing, except to even a further extent. And yes, would they say, you know, some babies are expendable if it's not measuring up to what they wanted? Of course. And this kind of gets into abortion in, you know, in an artificial womb. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. When does murder, you know, when does murder come into play, or whatever the law of the land is, depending on the state and stuff like that? And this is why this story is such a political minefield. And I think ectogenesis is still much further out, despite the technology essentially being here.
You mentioned the possibility of increasing equality among the sexes because women alone would not be responsible for carrying the child, giving birth to the child. But there's also some dubiousness among feminists who believe that science is going to be taking over something sacred and exclusive to women. Any discussions of that?
Well, yes. And, you know, I must say I'm going to side with some of the feminists on this point and just say it's true. It's very much true. If you subscribe value to being a person who can actually give birth, you know, through your human parts, then that is a very sacred thing to lose and a very sacred thing to give to science. However, the question really comes into being is what is the most functional thing, not only for society, but for the individual? And this is where we get into both the safety of the human being and the safety of the child itself. So this, again, it's not a clear cut, oh, this is right or this is wrong. It's really going to probably come down to a very personal choice and whether a mother wants to actually give up that very sacred and very special thing that they have been doing for, you know, so many hundreds of thousands of years now.
Zoltán István, so fascinating. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Zoltan Istvan is a futurist. He's a philosopher, journalist, and author. And he wrote the article, Artificial Wombs Are Coming, But the Controversy is Already Here for Motherboard. You'll find a link to read that article at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd love to know what you think. Is ectogenesis a technology that should stay in the pages of science fiction novels and on films? Do you think it would have a positive impact on families and society? Or would you wish to forego pregnancy in favor of using an artificial womb? You can let us know what you think by posting a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Some people may find the thought of an artificial womb to be a little creepy. For others, there's nothing creepier than a clown. Up next, a reporter heads to a clown convention to find out why membership is down. We'll also hear her case for appreciating the clown. That's coming up after the break when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Maybe there was a time when children liked clowns, but now not so much. There was that well-publicized 2008 study from England that found that most kids between 4 and 16 dislike and even fear images of clowns. Maybe you're among the many adults who find them creepy, too. Earlier this year, the New York Daily News reported that the U.S. is in grave danger of a clown shortage. Membership at the World Clown Association is down, and as older clowns retire, fewer young ones are stepping into their oversized shoes. Meanwhile, Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus reports intense competition for clowning jobs. So what's the truth? Lee Cowart traveled to a clowning convention to find out for herself. Her article, Don't Be Afraid of the Clowns, appeared in BuzzFeed. And Lee, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello.
So how much truth is there to this declaration of a clown crisis?
Well, it's a yes and no. When you think about circus clowns, it is kind of a dwindling art form in that there aren't younger people signing up in the same numbers that there used to be. However, clowning is a lot bigger than just the circus. So when you talk about clowning, are we talking about circus clowns, or are we talking about this very human and necessary way that we cope with things that are hard?
Well, where do those non-circus clowns find work?
Well, it helps to think about clowning as the opposite of stand-up. So compare Jon Stewart would be a stand-up comedian, and Stephen Colbert on his show is a clown, because for Stephen Colbert, the joke is on him, and for Jon Stewart, the joke is, what am I observing? So the act of clowning is this very physical thing that invites the audience to laugh at themselves through the person that's performing.
But we think of clown, and we think of white face paint, big red noses, funny wigs.
Mm-hmm.
So where does that tradition of clowning come from?
Well, the American idea of the clown is very rooted in Ringling Brothers. The circus coming to town was a very big part of American entertainment, and that image is so iconic. So for Americans, it's this childlike entertainment. It's very big and fun and kind of scary up close. But for many other cultures, the clown is more of a political symbol.
Open that up for us a little bit, the kind of the clown archetype. What are its origins?
So ancient clowns, or clowns from more primitive cultures, tended to be religious figures or medical figures. So they were very much an integral part of teaching the community the right way to act by demonstrating the wrong way to act. And also they could lampoon areas of tension and conflict with impunity. That is, they could make fun and it was protected because nobody wants to get into a fight with a clown. And so the ability of the clown to poke us in our softest, most vulnerable spots and make us laugh and not hurt is really important to just the survival and the enjoyment of daily life.
That is a sort of societal role that clowns used to play before in the, as you put it, you know, before Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus kind of days. But now people are really polarized about their feelings about clowns. Why do you think that is?
I think that's completely normal. And I don't think that's anything new. Jaron Aviv Hollander, a clown that I interviewed from Oakland, he said that Stephen King didn't make clowns scary. when he wrote Pennywise the Clown, he found something that was inherently scary, and he wrote about it.
And this was a character in his novel It, which was later made to a film.
Indeed. The first thing about clowns being scary is the makeup. And I like to refer to it as all caps face, because it was designed so that the people in the very, very back of these huge tents could have something to see and read on the performers in front. And you think about the way that these circus tents were lit, and it was candles, and they really needed huge eyes, huge mouth, a lot of contrast. And up close, it is the visual equivalent of being screamed at. Today, we interact with our entertainment at a very intimate level. You know, we have a tablet near our face. We look at our cell phones. And so if you get a text message and you look at your phone and it's a picture of a clown face right there, of course that's going to be scary. You're literally being screamed at with the makeup. So that's the first part of it. The other side of things is that there is an inherent disconnect. If you see someone with a painted-on smile and they're not smiling, then you already know they're lying to you. And people who are lying to you, like, that is going to make you uncomfortable. And then they're lying to you by pretending to be happy. And there's something really unsettling about really innocent intentions. Like, if all they want to do is make you happy, and yet you're sensing that there is conflict within them based on makeup versus expression or their dedication to the bit or whatever, that's going to be uneasy for you, and that's a reasonable thing to recoil from.
But at the same time, when you told people that you were going to the conference, your friends expressed concern for your well-being. What's behind that, and were you at all nervous?
I was nervous, and it makes sense when you realize that clown makeup is a mask. And when someone's wearing a mask, there's an inherent level of discomfort there because you can't be sure that what you're seeing is real, and that you can trust it, and that you can trust them. Aside from that, there is something really unsettling about pressing the elevator doors, and three clowns are just standing there. But at the same time, the great irony is that these people, like everyone I spoke to, was so dedicated to fighting that. They really wanted people to not be scared of them. And it almost seemed like if they could just say, you know what, this can be scary, and here's why, and let's work on it. The clowns that were able to do that tended to have more success at things like birthday parties, whereas the ones who didn't want to acknowledge that they could be scary tended to be more likely to, say, overstep a boundary.
You referred a little bit earlier to this idea of clowns mirroring who we are, you know, like comedians mirroring who we are, or reflecting some parts of ourselves that we may not always want to acknowledge. So what do you think, after confronting your own anxieties about clowns at this conference, where do you come away? I mean, are they still serving some sort of essential role in society, or, you know, are they going the way of the buggy whip?
I think clowns will always be essential in some capacity. Now, we may be looking at a change. You know, there's a new generation of clowns. Circus arts are coming back in a big way in the United States. So will there be a clown in 100 years? I think yes. Will it look like the clown today? Maybe not. But it will be absolutely necessary because they give us permission to laugh at ourselves and to laugh at all the things that are horrible, or that we are scared of, all of the things that make us human and messy, and all of those little idiosyncrasies that we like to hide because we're not supposed to show them. And the clown says everybody else has them too, and it's so ridiculous, and maybe it's okay to laugh at that.
Well, the clowns that you spoke to mostly regard the clown shortage as a myth, but are they getting work? Doing what?
You know, at the convention, the joke was that there was no shortage because if there were fewer clowns, they'd be getting more jobs. And the feeling was very much competition for them hasn't changed. They're not feeling like, oh, clowns are retiring and I'm getting more work. In fact, most of them were like, this is just the media doing what they do. They really, it was completely disregarded. I don't think anybody took it seriously.
Well, Lee, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Lee Coward is a freelance journalist. Her work has appeared in The Independent, Vice, Deadspin, among other places. Her latest piece, Don't Be Afraid of the Clowns, was on BuzzFeed. And you'll find a link to look at her article as well as some vivid images from the convention she attended at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Me here at last on the ground, you.
Even if we are facing a clown shortage, it could not possibly be as bad as a clown tragedy that took place on July 6, 1944, or, as it is better known, the day the clowns cried. Nearly 9,000 people had crowded into a circus big top in Hartford, Connecticut, when shortly after the show began, the tent caught fire. Its canvas had been waterproofed with a mixture of gasoline and wax, and it was completely consumed by flames in less than 10 minutes. The fire claimed more than 167 lives, more than a third of them children. Maureen Krekian, who was 11 at the time, survived and later remembered the disaster for this edition of StoryCorps.
Hartford this afternoon suffered one of the greatest catastrophes in its history. And during a matinee performance of Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus, the big tent suddenly burst into flame and burned to the ground.
It was 1944, July the 6th, a very hot day. I was 11 years old. I was supposed to go to the circus with the lady next door and her daughter. I went and knocked on the door and they weren't there. They had already left without me. Now, I had never been to the circus before. And there was no way that I was going to go home and tell my grandmother that I was alone. That would never have been permitted. So I just ran up the street and went to the circus by myself.
The Flying Walendas, world-famous aerial act, were performing on their trapezes when the fire broke.
I remember somebody yelling and seeing a big ball of fire near the top of the tent. And this ball of fire just got bigger and bigger and bigger.
An eyewitness told us that it appeared almost like spontaneous combustion, so quickly was the big tent a mass of flame.
By that time, everybody was panicking. The exit was blocked with the cages that the animals were brought in and out with, and there was a man taking kids and flinging them up and over that cage to get them out. I was sitting up, probably halfway up on the bleachers, and jumped down. You jumped down, it was all straw underneath, and there was a young man, a kid. He had a pocket knife, and he slit the tent, took my arm and pulled me out, and then I turned around and grabbed a kid. It was a little girl, and pulled her out.
The bleachers were burned to a crisp. 60 bodies were removed from that spot alone.
The spot where the tent had been was a charred mess of poles and wires. The
circus never came back to Hartford until the 70s, and then they never came back in a tent again. But I've never had desire to go.
What if that boy heard this interview? What would you like to say to him?
Oh, I'd like to throw my arms around him and thank him. I wouldn't be 74 years old today. I'd be long gone.
It's a tragedy Hartford will never forget, and everyone in Hartford hopes will never be repeated.
And that story told by Maureen Krekian, who survived the great circus disaster of July 4th, 1944. Speaking there for StoryCorps. Thank you so much for joining us today. Earlier, we spoke to Lee Cowart about her experiences at a clowning convention. Lee's been thinking and writing a lot about why we seek out laughter and what distinguishes clowns and comics. She told us why she thinks Jon Stewart falls on the side of comic, for example, while Stephen Colbert is more clown. Another comedian who often walked the line between comic and clown was Robin Williams, who died last week. Here's what Lee had to say about him.
He was perhaps the most iconic American clown. He made it okay for people for generations to laugh at themselves through him. He was never afraid to make his pain alleviate some of the ache of our own.
You can find a full version of Lee's thoughts on Robin Williams as iconic American clown. It's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. You get the full spectrum of human emotions here on Word of Mouth. Please join us for more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.